Okay, can you hear me?
I'm sitting here thinking, I can't hear you guys. I haven't joined the audio. Yeah, that's so funny.
Hello, and welcome to episode 6 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Dr. Justin Winzenberg and me, Stephen Jones. Today, we have a special episode in which we present more of the conversation we had with Dr. Karen Gustafson in episode 4. Dr. Gustafson holds a PhD in psychology from La Universidad de Palermo in Buenos Aires and is a beloved professor of psychology at Crown College in Minnesota. If you haven't had a chance to listen to episode 4, be sure to check it out. For this special episode, we'll jump right in to rejoin the conversation in which Karen presents the biopsychosocial-spiritual approach to mental wellness amidst the pandemic and lockdown.
What I am hoping to talk about is like where anxiety comes from and like the whole person look at anxiety, like applying it to our situation now.
And Karen, yeah, this will be a good tie-in because before joining us, Stephen and I were talking, and I was just mentioning that a low light of my past week is that I have these tendencies where I kind of just wake up with anxiety being there, you know, by default, and it's not always related to a thought pattern that I have, a distinct pattern in my brain where that I can identify the reason why it's there, and so it's just a general sense of uncomfortability that's been with me for quite some time in my life. So I kind of mentioned that as a low light. So this would be a good tie-in actually with what I mentioned earlier.
No, that's excellent. Because let me kind of add in, because that I think fits really well with not even understanding kind of the anxiety.
Yeah.
But sometimes we're just listening to our bodies that are anxious, and then we just think we are anxious and then kind of go from there. So yeah, if that makes sense.
Yes.
That's all kind of part of it. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Karen, I appreciate what you're saying here. And I think a lot about my own experiences of anxiety in my life. And I notice times where I won't necessarily have any cognitive awareness of what the threat might be, even though I'm feeling the deep anxiety emotionally. Like it can be present there from the moment that I wake up, and it's like I'll try to even mine my brain and wonder what is it that I'm afraid of, or what is it that's causing this. And there's times where I can't identify that, but then I notice that there are other times where I can actually pinpoint cognitively what it might be that I'm fearful of that might be causing the anxiety. And usually I can kind of confirm whether that's the case when that threat dissipates and all of a sudden I'm feeling better, right?
Yeah.
What do we do? I've always wondered, you know, how do we deal with this tension between at times knowing that there are things in our brain that are definite pinpoints for our anxieties, but that there are other times when we don't even know where they're coming from and yet it's present there. Like there were times in my life where I would wake up in the morning, and I remember this when I was in my 20s, where I could barely get to work. It would take me hours, a couple of hours before I could start getting to work on some of the projects that I needed to do, because the anxiety was so high that I felt like I was about to like explode inside. And I'm like, how would you coach or maybe help people who are having experiences with anxiety that cannot be pinpointed by specifics versus those experiences maybe where there are specific things that we know are the threat?
That's great. I think part of the answer is even like a biological answer of exercise really helps. Eating right, sleeping right, having activities that will actually calm your body, and finding routines that will help, you know, say to your body even, it's okay, I'm okay. And like trying to not let the body spiral you like into not being able to then move to the next step. And we'll talk about also kind of the freezing point too of anxiety and some ways of getting past that. But just on the biological side of us, I think it's really important to be noticing the signs in our body of that anxiety and having routines of walking, exercising, being outside if, you know, when we can, just watching nature. Like this week I'm watching like the little hosta outside my door, you know, growing, and just like that calmness of this slow, tiny green coming back and shooting up. So I think finding even ways to like say to our body, calm.
I totally resonate with what you're saying. You know, in those moments where I was having that high level anxiety, I would almost have to go on pretty long walks. And I felt like after that, I could kind of get back to things. And I was in a fortunate, well, maybe unfortunate, I guess, but a fortunate stage in my life where I was a brand new PhD student at the time. And so my work was not something where I had to go to a place and punch in on a clock. And people who are experiencing that kind of work environment, I can just sympathize with how difficult it can be in the midst of that kind of anxiety to get on with work. What I also noticed for myself, though, was that kind of anxiety completely got in the way of me doing the kind of work that I needed to do. I mean, when research, you know, it's so much about digging into books and focusing your brain, but you're feeling this high levels of anxiety. So in some ways I was fortunate, I didn't have to punch in at a clock, I didn't have to go someplace, so I could take those long walks to clear my head. I was unfortunate because it probably took me 8 hours to get about 2 hours of work done, you know, and trying to manage this at this really heightened time in my life. I mean, it's just, So that idea of the biological component and actually kind of getting your body in these routines, I really sympathize with that. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Well, and Justin, what you just said is fabulous too, because the physical environment around us too does play a part in that. So if we can be even organized in our physical spaces, so say now we're at home working, rather than, you know, working in the kitchen and working, you know, outside and working at that table and at that desk, if we can have even like an organization of, this is my workspace and this is my play space, this is my rest space, this is my family space, can also like be telling your body and associating, this is work time. And that time routine too can help us. Like work time is gonna be at my desk from 8 to noon or whatever. But then play time is gonna be from 12 to 1 as we do lunch somewhere else. And I will do play time to 1, family time to 1, and then back to work. So that, you know, you're kind of saying to your body too, the anxiety about whatever we have to be doing gets structured in my spaces kind of as well, rather than even kind of like a free floating anxiety, because even our workspace becomes kind of free floating.
Yeah, you know, I've been wondering about something too as it relates to the question of anxiety. I'd be interested to get your take on it. When I was in grad school and seminary at Bethel, they offered like 10 free counseling sessions to all the students there, which I found to be very, very helpful. And that was one of those moments where I was going through this sort of intense anxiety, you know, just prior to me starting my PhD program. And I went through the counseling there, and something that I noticed that was interesting, you would probably be much more familiar with the terminology of these things, but I feel like there's this tendency sometimes to want to mine our past to figure out why the anxieties are there, as if maybe we had some trauma, you know, maybe there's a specific moment, and not that that's maybe unhelpful. I'm sure, you know, I'd love to hear your take on the value or the dangers maybe in doing such a thing. But the particular kind of therapy that I went through was this interesting model. I don't even know what it's called, but it was less focused on mining your past to figure out where things came from, and it was more focused on your imagination and your emotional response to say, rather than where does this come from, it was more questions about what am I seeing? What am I visualizing in my head when I'm feeling those anxieties? And then how do you kind of retweak your brain to think differently about what you're seeing happen in this sort of, mm-hmm. you know, film reel of your head. What do you think about that? I mean,
Oh, wow. Yes. So the next part to me beyond the biology is the you know, biopsycho, is our mind, is our thinking, is our emotions. And I really appreciate what you've said, not needing like to mine everything from the past. But I think what's really helpful is noticing like what we've labeled things in the past and how to relabel. Hmm. Just an example of like even how are we labeling this moment in our lives? Like, are we saying, you know, like, oh, this is the worst catastrophe that we've ever, you know, gone through? Are we labeling it as when I bottomed out in my career? You know, that just colors how we're going to feel, think over everything. But I think what's really helpful is looking at how we have put meaning or labels over situations and then rewrite like new labels, even labels to pass on. You know, I've been thinking a lot about my family this week. My mother, it had during the polio epidemic, she got polio in 1952 before the polio vaccine came out.
Wow.
While pregnant with, I have two older brothers, while she's pregnant with my next oldest brother, and she's, you know, paralyzed, laying in bed, pregnant, my dad, you know, can't really, you know, care for her or my oldest brother because he has to go to work. So they took my oldest brother to my grandma's house to live, but my mother, while, you know, during, there's no vaccine for the polio, the story that got written over that, that got passed down to us, is while she's there, she just feels Jesus' presence and knows, Lord, I can't take care of my son. I can't, you know, what am I going to do with the new son that gets born? I can't walk, but I'm yours. And actually, a few weeks later, while praying at the Wednesday night prayer meeting, my mother felt this just warmth come over her spine.
Wow.
Next day she was up walking, healed.
How about that?
And, you know, she lived till 86, walking fine. My brother's fine. My oldest brother's fine. But what I kept thinking about was even the faith story that got written in a previous time in my family. My grandfather, who was a pastor, had pneumonia before penicillin vaccine, you know, could cure that. But he, and they prayed for him, but he didn't live. And my mom was 5 when he died. My grandmother was left with 5 little kids. But the story my grandmother wrote over all that was the deep love of God and his protection over them. And so these stories that have gotten passed on have made such an impact in my own life of, boy, when something happens that I can't control, that the story that's been passed on to me is, but God still loves us, and he's got us.
I love what you're saying. You know, in biblical studies, I think what you're talking about, and I know you're aware of this, is hermeneutics. Because in some ways, what you're talking about is the meaning that we give to these moments in our life. And so it's an interpretive move, right? It's there are these, yes, there are these external empirical realities that are happening to us, but then it's the meaning that we attribute to it that can lead us down the road to anxiety, or that can lead us to less anxiety and to freedoms and to experiences, and even with God, that are liberating. And so the necessity or actually maybe the primacy of making this sort of interpretive move to try to understand God's presence in the midst of these stories, it's very intentional, and it's so significant. I just love how it's connected to sort of the biblical studies realm in that way.
Beautiful, beautiful. And I think that too is why, you know, the connection then to the spiritual side of us, mm-hmm, like, okay, we, you know, working on the biological side that influences us, our feelings, our emotions, naming, right, our thoughts, naming those labels we've put over things, making new meaning, noticing our feelings. But the social and spiritual side of us too all interacts too, where, and I think, you know, back to even what anxiety does, is making us either fight, flee, or just freeze. And I think we do that socially and spiritually too in anxiety. Like, right now, so we don't really have a threat that we can name and go after and attack. It's a virus. So it ends up often that we're going to attack or fight against others.
Oh, that makes so much sense. So we make a visible enemy, exactly, because, yeah,
exactly. And that's just, you know, so hard.
So heightened social tensions would make sense, right?
Yes.
Like, they're not unexpected. It's what we do because we're trying to make our psychological world make sense.
Exactly. I mean, I just felt so bad about what happened that I did at the grocery store last week. I was there, you know, with my mask on. Everybody had their mask on. And there was kind of an older woman. To my students, she would be very old. To me, kind of old. And she had a mask on too and was 6 feet away. But she's saying something to me that I can't understand. It's a very strong accent. And she's like trying to give me a can of peanuts. And I'm going, no, thank you, no, thank you. You know, and I could just feel myself like, why are you getting close to me? Why are you giving me these peanuts? And I can't understand what she's saying. Finally, it dawns on me. She's asking me about salt, and can't figure out and read on the can, are these salted peanuts or are they unsalted peanuts? And so I take the can and I go, no salt.
Wow. So she was asking for help and you were perceiving threat.
Exactly.
Wow. How about that?
And so then, you know, and she thanks me and I go, you know, be well. But I just felt so horrible, you know, that my first reaction was, why is she giving me this, you know, reaching out with this box or, can of peanuts? And my reaction, I think it is just that fight or, you know, flight, even kind of an emotional flight from people, or kind of that freezing. But the spiritual side, I think, can be the same even with the Lord. Like, you know, in that kind of fighting mood of, God, why did you do this to me? Or the fleeing mood with God of, you know, not being able to worship like we used to. And so we just kind of don't, or we just kind of retreat from Him, or just freeze, you know, even in our spiritual life. But like, back to what, you know, Justin is saying, even of, you know, the meaning, one thing that has happened to me this week, I'm in Ephesians, and I've been stuck on one phrase at the end of Ephesians 1 that is just, the fullness of him who fills everything in every way. And I went, oh my Lord. And I have been stuck on that phrase. I hope it's okay to be in only one phrase in the word all week long. That, you know, Jesus fills everything in every way. And I've just been asking him, Lord, Jesus, just fill this time in every way you want to.
Yeah, like what you're saying there, I even think of Ephesians 6, you know, where Paul's describing the struggle and the battle and the, you know, the armor of God. And then he gets to prayer as kind of the last one. But then he ends the letter by actually requesting that they pray for him, that he would have boldness to proclaim the gospel. And he's in prison, you know. You get the sense even, it's subtle, but that Paul is anxious about this opportunity to proclaim the gospel and that he needs the prayers of others to kind of be sustained in the midst of this trying environment. Wow. And so the necessity of prayer and the fact that there is this spiritual battle, and then he directly invokes what seemed to be pretty straightforward circumstances of what he's facing at the time. So the connection even between the battle that he sees in the spiritual realm, the need to kind of, you know, arm one against that battle and to stand firm against it, and at the same time knowing that his circumstances, you know, are trying and pressing and needing the prayers of others. It's, I think it's a powerful point there too.
Yes, yes. And I love too what you're saying, and Paul in 2 Corinthians, you know, is going that he was facing fears within, conflicts without, and God comforts him, but he comforts him by the coming of Titus. And so it's like, you know, that social part is so important too, of not fighting against, not fleeing, not freezing, but even connecting now in a deeper way than we maybe ever have before, of, you know, saying, this is really what's going on in my heart and life. Connect with me and I connect with you. Pray for me, you know, comfort me.
Thank you for joining us for this special episode of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. If you haven't had a chance to listen to the rest of the conversation we had with Karen, go check out episode 4. Our theme music is by Josiah Enns. We hope you can join us for coffee again next week.